Coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Some of these things that we perceive to be healthy, that we just think are totally normal to eat on a Friday night or grab for breakfast or serve in school lunches, are actually causing these glucose spikes.
The health of your entire body is rooted in the health of your gut. Hippocrates said, disease begins in the gut, and so does health. Over the last decade, research on the importance of the gut microbiome has exploded, which led me to ask the question, is there a simple daily way to transform your gut microbiome? Turns out there is. With the help of a few experts and years of research, I've created the ultimate multivitamin for your microbiome, and it's called Gut Food. Gut Food uses the power of three critical gut-supporting components, prebiotics, probiotics, and polyphenols, and five ingredients at clinically validated dosages to help reduce inflammation, support the growth of beneficial gut bacteria, improve digestion and bloating, and support mood and energy. I created this product because it's what I wanted, and I wanted to offer it to all my patients because nurturing your gut health can literally transform your life. I'm so excited about Gut Food, and I know you're going to love it. Check it out at gutfood.com.
When I get dressed in the morning, I want to feel comfortable and ready for the whole day, from my meditation and workout to grabbing lunch or going to a meeting, which is why I'm obsessed with Vuori. Ever since I tried Vuori's clothes on, I've been hooked, and I literally have not wanted to wear anything else. They're that comfortable. I've turned so many of my friends onto Vuori, and now my team is hooked too. The women's performance jogger has become a staff favorite because they are super soft and come in a ton of different colors. They also have pockets, which is a huge bonus and makes it easier to listen to your favorite podcast like this one. My team has also been telling me how much they love the women daily leggings made with Vuori's special wicking smoothing fabric. A few women on my team have even gotten multiple colors so they can wear them every day for yoga, cycling, running, and anything else. Aside from the fact that I love their products, I feel good supporting Vuori because they believe in ethical manufacturing, community initiatives, and sustainability. They even offset 100% of their carbon footprint, and they're committed to using 80% sustainable materials. Vuori is an investment in your happiness. Right now, they're offering my community 20% off your first purchase at vuoriclothing.com/pharmacies. That's Vuori, V-U-O-R-I. clothing.com/pharmacy, F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. You'll also get free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Check out vuoriclothing.com/pharmacy and you'll see why my team and I love their stuff so much.
Now, so many of my patients ask me how I manage to work multiple jobs, travel frequently, and spend time with my family and still focus on my health. I know it can seem hard to eat well when you got a lot going on, but the trick is to never let yourself get into a food emergency and to stay stocked up with the right things to support your goals. So recently I discovered Paleo Valley beef sticks. I keep these beef sticks at home and at the office, so I know that whenever I'm in a food emergency, I have a healthy and delicious option to keep me on track. It's no secret that I have high standards when it comes to what I put in my body, and Paleo Valley beef sticks checks all the boxes. They're gluten-free, grain-free, dairy-free, soy-free, and non-GMO. Plus, they use 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, which not only adds to the flavorful taste, but it also means they're free of any harmful antibiotics or hormones that you'll find in most meat. With grass-fed beef, you'll get more nutrients than you would with beef fed with grains. Things like higher levels of omega-3 fats that help reduce inflammation, and more B vitamins and other antioxidants to support your body's converting food into energy, and also more of the fat-soluble vitamins that are beneficial for a healthy heart. Plus, instead of being processed with chemicals and other questionable ingredients, these beef sticks are naturally fermented, so you get gut-friendly probiotics with every bite. How cool is that? Right now, Paleo Valley is offering my listeners 15% off your entire first order. Just go to paleovalley.com/Hyman to check out all their clean paleo products and take advantage of this deal. That's paleovalley.com/Hyman. I definitely recommend stocking up on the grass-fed beef sticks to keep in your house, in your car, and in your office. It's one of my favorite tricks to staying healthy while on the go. All right, now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren Feehan, one of the producers of The Doctor's Pharmacy podcast. Blood sugar is an aspect of our biology that has major implications for how we feel and function on a daily basis. And the good news is balancing your blood sugar doesn't have to be difficult, and you'll start to notice the benefits right away. In today's episode, we feature three conversations from the doctor's pharmacy on what to eat to manage your blood sugar, as well as tips on how to combine foods to minimize blood sugar spikes. Dr. Hyman speaks with Dr. Casey Means on the best and worst foods for blood sugar, with Jesse and Chowsby on tips and tricks to minimize spikes, and with Drew Prowitt on the benefits of adding fat and protein to starchy foods. Let's dive in.
We have 51 million glucose data points, and this is just amongst our closed beta program, 16,000 people who have gone through our closed beta program. You know, we have almost 200,000 people on our wait list. So you can imagine that 51 million data points is going to get a lot larger when we start opening to more people. We have those 51 million glucose data points paired with 1.3 million food logs. So we can start to see for the first time ever how specific foods across a population are affecting glucose and creating this population data of a closed loop biofeedback. You mentioned the individualized aspect of this. That is so true. And that paper that you referenced, Personalized Nutrition by Prediction of Glycemic Responses, that was done about 5 years ago in Israel, showed how variable it is person to person. We could both, of course, eat the exact same cookie, and you and I could have a very different glucose response based on several factors like our microbiome, our underlying insulin resistance, et cetera. So that's a really important aspect, is for the individual, what kind of data they can get to really, truly personalize their own data based on glucose response. Because of course, and we talked about this a lot in our last episode, a more stable glucose level with more gentle rolling hills after meals, avoiding the huge spikes and valleys that we see after eating large amounts of carbohydrates and sugar. That's what we want. We want the gentle rolling hills, the low glucose response. So you can start to see that in yourself and shape your diet very quickly. On the population level, then we get to see something interesting as well that actually can benefit anyone, not just the people who have a sensor on, because this becomes a database that really informs the nutrition industry like we've never been able to before, where we start to see radical transparency about what food is actually doing to people's bodies. And I personally think in 5 years, it's going to seem incredibly outdated, incredibly quaint to walk into the grocery store and choose foods based on what the box says, you know, based on interests that are not aligned with your thriving and well-being. They're aligned with taking you to your bliss point, making you dependent for it, making your dopaminergic reward systems want to keep coming back, but it's not aligned necessarily with your health. And so we're going to start to see this huge new way of choosing foods. I can imagine, you know, like a person with polycystic ovarian syndrome, for instance, a condition that we know is directly related to insulin resistance. And studies have shown that low-carb diets, a healthy Mediterranean ketogenic diet for just 12 weeks can actually reverse PCOS. This was a study done just a couple of years ago. So there's people, and women are very savvy with their research, and they're going out and they're reading the books, they're reading these papers, and they know they need to keep their glucose and insulin under control. They know that just being prescribed a birth control pill and metformin is not the answer to their long-term health. And so, you know, they're looking for tools. And you can imagine that woman, her doctor says to her, you know, oh, you don't have diabetes. You don't need to worry about blood sugar. You have PCOS. It's very different. They know, though. They've read. They do their research. We're not, you know, people are very smart, very informed. They know they're going to keep they're going to work to keep their blood sugar down, because they know that in the research that shows that it will help. So they go to the grocery store now with this app, with something that they can actually look up every food they're buying and see exactly across tens of thousands of people what it's doing to people's blood sugar. So you go into the non-dairy milk aisle and you've got 15 different options. You've got oat milk, you've got almond milk, you've got cashew milk, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, what the heck are you supposed to get? And you think you're making a good choice because you're buying an unsweetened non-dairy milk. But the reality is, from our data set, that there are some of those that give you a monumental spike, even if they're unsweetened. Oat milk, you know, and then there's others that actually have virtually no glucose response. So that person now can take their health into their own hand, make a consumer decision, not based on marketing, that's going to serve their goals. And I am so excited for that world, because people are going to start, I think, demanding from food companies to actually create products that are not creating a huge amount of glycemic variability or these ups and down spikes. And you can't hide from that data. And so I'm really thrilled that of what that's going to do. So circling back to your main question of kind of like some of the themes that we've seen.
What do we see?
I think one of the first things that's really interesting is our demographics, actually. So aside from glucose data, actually 52% of our beta members are women. And this is so different than what you hear in the mainstream media. You know, there's a New York Times article about levels that talks about how this is for the worried well and the biohacker guys and the longevity crazy, you know, and it's like, that is not the reality. The reality is this is mostly women in their ages of 30 to 40. So very similar to the demographic I was talking about with people who are at high risk for things like PCOS, and their primary reason for wanting to use a CGM, what they report to us is weight loss, followed by finding their optimal diet. Of men, in the 48% who are men, their number one goal is optimal diet as well. So people are clearly interested in finding what actually works for them. You know, if you go back to what you're talking about with COVID, you know, the CDC just announced yesterday, finally admitted that 75% of the people dying of COVID have four or more of these largely preventable cardiometabolic, you know, comorbidities. Wow. People know, they know now, and now it's finally coming out in the mainstream media that we've got to get the blood sugar under control. So that's one thing we're seeing is really interesting demographics. This is not the worried well. This is not the, you know, like for the celebrity rich and famous. You know, this is for people who want to just figure out their diet and lose weight, which is great. The second thing we've seen a lot of is that foods that are commonly touted as healthy or that we perceive to be healthy may actually be generating shockingly high glucose spikes. And I think we particularly see this around breakfast foods. We certainly see common snacks, drinks, common takeout foods. And we can certainly dive into like the details on those. But it's amazing how some of these things that we just think are totally normal to just eat on a Friday night or whatever, that they're actually or grab for breakfast or serve in school lunches at schools are actually causing these huge glucose spikes. And then I think another thing that's been really interesting is showing people combinations and alternatives of foods that they can do that will do better. So for instance, combinations, we see a lot of people log something like an apple, and then they'll log an apple with like peanut butter and yogurt. And that peanut butter and yogurt is adding, of course, fat and protein. Sometimes they'll put some chia seeds on that. That's some fiber. And we've definitely seen that when carbohydrates, sort of naked carbohydrates like a fruit, are paired with fat, protein, and fiber, people do better. In terms of alternatives, we've seen some really interesting things. We just published an article on Chipotle. We see people logging all sorts of things at Chipotle. Some of them, disaster for glucose. Some of them, virtually no glucose response, like an average of 7 milligrams per deciliter, very low. So that the really, you know, minimal glucose spiking things is the keto bowl. This is a salad that has protein, you know, fajita veggies, guacamole, salsa, virtually no glucose spike, tons of nutrients. Burritos, on the other hand, with that gigantic tortilla, send people on average through the roof.
Wow.
So people start learning, if I'm going to go to McDonald's, if I'm going to go to Chipotle, if I'm going to go to Sweetgreen, what should I order that's going to give me the best, you know, bang for my buck in terms of blood sugar. And then I think the last thing I would
say, everybody's different, right? Everyone. Everybody's different, right? So, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, what works for you, like you say, oh, well, I found that this screwed up my blood sugar. It doesn't mean it's going to screw up your friend's blood sugar, right?
That's definitely true. So these are more the population-based sort of things that we're seeing that can kind of give you, I think, a general gestalt of where you should start. And then, of course, it's about actually trying it for yourself and seeing what actually works for you. There may be that person out there that doesn't spike to a huge flour tortilla, but for most people, you know, knowing that getting the keto bowl is going to have totally stable blood sugar on average for the population, they can at least go in there and get that and see what it does to them. So it kind of, I think, nudges people in the right direction. And then the last big insight that I think we're seeing is around, this is so simple, but it's profound, is walking. We have seen that a simple walk after eating significantly reduces glucose responses. And we actually did an experiment with our members where we sent people a 12-ounce can of Coke, and two of them, and we said, hey, if you want to do this, drink this Coke on one day, and then on the next day, drink the Coke and take a walk right after you drink it.
Yeah.
And we actually saw across this population that of the people who completed both aspects of the experiment, the median delta of the glucose rise was 33% lower if you just took a walk. So that was going from an average of 162 milligram per deciliter peak to 132. Over the course of your lifetime, if you're doing this every day, that's a huge difference.
So how soon do you have to walk after you eat?
Well, there's a lot of research that looks into this, and it really comes down to the sooner the better. If any time you walk after a meal, even if it's an hour or two, do it. That's fantastic. But because our glucose tends to peak in about that within an hour after a meal, I would say what I would recommend to people is after a meal, you know, finish the conversation, 15, 20 minutes, get up with the family, take a spin around the block, you know, put the dishes in the sink, go take a nice stroll around the block, and then come back. And if you don't want to walk outside because it's cold, put on some great music and have a dance party in the kitchen, or like do a few squats. Like, it's really just about moving, but these are significant effects. So that's kind of the general layout of some of the things that have been so interesting to me, just from looking at this huge, huge data set.
That's just so fascinating. It's like we just sort of have this one size fits all approach in traditional medicine, and it's just so far from that, right? You also learn about, for example, what would be things we should never eat? Like, what are those things we should just never eat?
Well, I'll go off of just what we're learning in our data set, like, because we could obviously, and I could talk about this forever about general principles, but
I think getting to the specific data is just so fascinating. That's why I want to get into it.
Absolutely. Of the categories of things that at this point, based on what we've learned, I would not really eat anymore would be certain candies, which I'll go into each of these in more detail, cereals, certain cereals, soda for sure, fast food, and lots of common takeout. So when we look at candy, this is actually really interesting. The worst food in our entire data set of 51 million glucose data points is...
I want to hear this. Drum roll, please.
Skittles.
Wow.
Not surprising, because it's a refined carbohydrate. You know, obviously there's refined sugar in there, but it's also kind of a naked carb, right? It doesn't actually have fat, protein, and fiber. Like, a Snickers bar at least has some fat and some protein. The Skittles are just like naked carbs. So the Skittles have an
naked carbs. I love that term. I never heard that. I love that.
They're just on their own, you know, like, and you can think of like fat, protein, and fiber as kind of clothing the carbs. So Skittles have an average glucose rise in our data set of 83 milligrams per deciliter. So that's certainly going to take you up.
Huge.
It's way more than a Coca-Cola, and you are going to almost inevitably crash after that type of spike. Because of course, when you spike that high, you release all this insulin to soak up that glucose out of the bloodstream. And that huge surge of insulin can overshoot. You know, the body responds sort of in an exaggerated way. You take up all that glucose, and then people often dip to below their baseline and have that reactive hypoglycemia after the spike, which is when they feel shaky, tired, lethargic.
So go out and then down.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You want to, the beauty of achieving more of the gentle rolling hills is that you don't end up having that reactive hypoglycemia that can make you feel really crappy, that post-meal slump that people are often like, oh, I just need a cup of coffee or something. It's like, no, it's the Skittles, you know? And so Skittles have a huge, the other candies that are in the worst part of our data set are Sour Patch Kids, caramel corn, Twizzlers, and jelly beans. So you notice they all are similar. They're all these kind of
jelly beans,
not chocolatey, not no protein, no fat, just like straight, you know, congealed sugar, basically. So those are the candies.
We used to have those things when I was a kid. It was like this powdered stuff, Lick-O-Mate or something. Like, I forget what it's called. You'd put a stick in, you'd lick it, just pure sugar.
Yes. And the stick was made out of sugar too. Wasn't it like a candy stick?
I never, I don't remember seeing that anymore. I mean, I don't really look for it, but I was like, that was my main go-to thing. It's like when I was 6, 7 years old, I wanted the Lick-A-Maid with the sugar. It was like a fentanyl lollipop, you know?
I mean, we use sugar as a pain management tool in hospitals. You know, this is abhorrent, but when children undergo circumcision in the hospital in their first days of life, what do they give them for pain medication? This little dropper called a Sweeties, which is just sugar water. That is the analgesic. Wow. So it's like exactly like you said, it literally is like a fentanyl lollipop. So that's candy. So yeah, so get rid of the Skittles. You know, a Snickers bar literally has half the glucose spike of Skittles. So it's pretty amazing. Then it's cereals. Amazing. Oh my gosh. Get the cereal out of the house.
We should eat those. So you mentioned takeout and other things too, right?
Well, just to tell about the cereals, Cinnamon Toast Crunch, Honey Nut Cheerios, Lucky Charms, about 60 or above on glucose responses.
Wait. Honey Nut Cheerios. So we think honey is good, nut is good, and Cheerios are good. So it's like a wolf in sheep's clothing, it sounds like.
After Cinnamon Toast Crunch, it's the worst. Yeah.
Oh my God. Worse than Fruit Loops or Pebbles or Cocoa Puffs or any of that?
Those, I haven't checked those precisely in our data set, but when you look at just like the top 50 worst foods that people log, all three of those, I mean, these kids are going to school after having these spikes and crashes. And, you know, Mark, like a lot of them are probably eating a glass of OJ on the side, which, you know, these are isolated food logs. So,
I mean, you know, Casey, I just break in for a minute. I remember when I was filming the movie Fed Up and one of the scenes was where the mother was like trying to get her kids to lose weight and her family to lose weight. And she's like, well, what I really focused on is healthy breakfast cereals. And she pulls out these cereals that are marketed as, quote, health foods. I mean, Kellogg, who invented breakfast cereal as a breakfast food, which wasn't a thing, right? These are basically dessert for breakfast. Yes. It's 75% sugar. And it's that is, you know, having a soda with breakfast. So I think people need to get that cereal and starch for breakfast is a huge no-no. And if you can do one thing to change your biology quickly, is get rid of any starch or sugar for breakfast.
Yes. Yes. You said that it's like eating sugar for breakfast. I will up the ante here. It's much worse than eating dessert for breakfast. Peach pie has an average glucose spike of 46 milligrams per deciliter. Cinnamon Toast Crunch is 59. And they both have, of course, the refined seed oils and the flour. It's worse. So,
okay, give me the peach pie. I love peach pie.
I know. Exactly. Exactly. So you mentioned, you know, getting rid of the breakfast foods that have the refined starches. This has been one of the most fascinating things we've seen because all the common American breakfast foods are in the worst 100 foods that score. And these, just to run through them really quick, we're talking about, this is in our worst 50 foods. Egg McMuffin, bagel with cream cheese, French toast, Pop-Tarts, cereal, English muffin, blueberry scone, cinnamon roll, Cheerios, croissant, toast with jam. Those are all above a 40 milligram per deciliter spike. So that's a big spike.
Which is a lot.
It's a lot. If you look at then the best foods in our data set, like very little glucose spike, you also see a handful of breakfast foods. And so these are the ones we want to eat.
Like what?
We see frittata. We see avocado and egg, avocado and greens, chia pudding, Greek yogurt and berries. And we actually see this, a lot of people log this, I think because Kelly Levesque is sort of close in our network, but we get a lot of logs for the Fab Four smoothie, which is a smoothie that she has popularized, which is really balanced. It has very minimal fruit, a lot of protein, fiber, fat, and greens. And all of those that I just mentioned all score below 20 milligrams per deciliter. So you want to get, it's basically, Mark, it's the vegan diet. Like it's, you know, there people you can read your book and like it's, but it's the beautiful sort of like nutrient dense foods that none of those have refined carbs. And I think people sometimes assume that, oh, if I'm going to have a keto breakfast or a low carb breakfast, I need to eat the animal products. That's not true. Half of those things I just mentioned don't have animal products, the Fab Four smoothie, the chia pudding. You could do non-dairy yogurt with some berries, some avocado with, you know, and so that's just something important to remember that breakfast is, this one's straightforward. Don't eat those first things, eat those things. So
fat and protein for breakfast, get rid of the starch and sugar.
Yes.
Very important. And I think it's super important. I mean, I used to, in my
sugar detox book, I created a smoothie, which is essentially nuts and seeds. So it was raw nuts, almonds, walnuts, pecans, whatever, hemp seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, putting in like cranberries, which is actually very low glycemic, the lemon, maybe some berries, unsweetened macadamia milk or whatever. And it's like basically, and greens you can put in there, an avocado, and it's basically a protein and fat smoothie. It tastes delicious.
Yeah.
And it's not all the typical, I mean, oh my God, like things like Ensure, Boost, all these sort of meal replacement things. Most, you know, traditional smoothies are full of sugar, artificial sweeteners, or processed, highly processed protein powders. I mean, it's so good to get just real food. So I love that, a real food smoothie. I want to ask you a couple more questions. So there are a bunch of things you learned just because this is such a new area. We're just learning about in real time what happens to real people in a continuous glucose monitoring setting, which people have to realize this is not a technology that's been around for a long time. It's relatively recent, and it's even more recent that it's being used at scale by non-diabetics. So that's a huge thing. We're just learning stuff that we just never had insight into before, and Levels is capturing that data and making sense of it. And it has so many beautiful lessons. And for you, I mean, for anybody listening, you know, Levels is going to be launching. It's a great technology to actually see what's going on with your own biology. And I was super surprised too and shocked. And I'll just give you a little anecdote of what happened to me. But the first night we got it, I used it and I was at my friend's and we had this big dinner. We ordered all the healthiest food from this like regenerative farm and like lamb and all these veggies. And it was like so healthy and not sugar. There was no starch. It was like amazing. And we like ate so much food. Like we just ate a huge volume of food, of healthy food. And we both were like going to bed, checking our sugar and texting each other, like, what happened? Our sugar's like 160. This is freaking me out. What's up? Like, any big meal also can cause a spike. But there's a few things you learn. One is, what are the surprising things you learn that we should really never eat? I mean, sorry, that we should, that actually spike your blood sugar that are surprising to you? And what foods might not actually spike your blood sugar, but you still should get kind of rid of?
This is such a great question. The five, you asked for some surprising foods that spike blood sugar. I want to preface this answer by saying that some of these foods, it's not necessarily that you should avoid them completely because they're actually nutrient dense whole foods. It's that it's good to be aware of how they're affecting you so that you can figure out how to eat the food in some different way. You know, maybe eat a smaller portion, maybe pair it more with fat, protein, and fiber, maybe take a walk afterwards. But the intention is not to hear these foods and then say, oh, I can't eat that again. It's not a good food. So this is the brings me to one of the first ones, which is certain fruits. There are certain fruits that spike people on average a lot more than others. The ones that we see in the data set are banana, which is maybe not that surprising, but wow. Grapes. Grapes have an average glucose spike of over 40 milligrams per deciliter, whereas like a mandarin orange, for instance, is like 20. So it's a very big difference. We also see even within fruits, like different types of oranges, a mandarin orange has a low spike. A sumo orange is almost double that. And I mean, those sumo oranges are like so unbelievably delicious. And, you know, it also could be kind of a size thing, but, you know, chop up those oranges, put them in some yogurt and add some Zen basil, you know, seeds or chia seeds or something with tons of fiber. It's going to potentially blunt that spike. So fruit juice is not a huge surprise, but like orange juice, huge spike, average of 40 milligrams per deciliter. So I would say, of course, avoid liquid sugar, which I would consider juices to be liquid sugar. But certain fruits do have more of a spike than others for sure. The next one, corn on the cob. Average glucose spike of 46 milligrams per deciliter, which is the same.
What if you lather it in butter?
Well, maybe doing some grass-fed. Yeah, I think it's a good point.
Grass-fed beef with it as before.
Or grass-fed butter, you know, some really nice butter, some ghee. I actually put corn now. I only use corn really now within recipes because I know that if I eat corn alone, it's going to spike me. So for instance, I make these really great hearts of palm crab cakes. So they're crabless crab cakes and they have some corn in there. They don't spike me. I eat it with an avocado relish. There's lots of other stuff going on. So I just have figured out how to balance it to not spike me. We also see big spikes to some foods that are totally marketed as low carb, like I hate to throw, you know, some certain brands under the bus, but Smart Sweets, you know, they market themselves as having significantly less sugar than other candy, but they have a higher glucose spike on average than a cinnamon roll. So that's where marketing, you know, people are like, oh, crazy. I'm gonna eat the low carb candy. You got to test it on yourself. And then this one was interesting. So the fasting mimicking diet has become really popular.
Yeah.
And actually,
yes. Oh,
this one in our top 10 worst scoring foods. So right next to Skittles is.
You mean the fasting mimicking diet, the Prolon diet?
Wow. The tomato soup. Has an average glucose spike of 53 milligrams per deciliter. I don't quite know.
So it wasn't the whole program.
Nope.
It wasn't the whole program.
This is an individual food. Yeah.
One of the soups. So then I need to talk to Walter Longo and tell him to swap out that soup. You should just send it to him.
I will. I'm going to. I'll send in the episode. You know, we have not met personally, but you know, the thing is, their results of the data of that program are profound, and it is clearly evidence-based that it is extremely effective for improving cardiometabolic biomarkers. Yes. What I would say, though, is that there's probably a way to even more tweak that program if the ingredients were slightly modified. I don't think that glucose spike in the context of basically eating like 500 calories a day for 5 days is really going to hurt people, but we want to reduce glycemic variability, you know, and it's probably pretty simple to swap out some ingredients there. So that's good information to have, you know, and I think the last thing I'd mention that has really blown me away is the energy bars. We probably have over 50 different types of energy bars logged in the data set, you know, ranging from Quest bars, Bulletproof bars, Clif bars, Luna bars, you know, all of these. And the spectrum is profound. We see that.
Yeah, somebody's like, what bar should I eat? It's such a big question. What protein bar? What bar do I have? What's good? And people are eating stuff. And I'm like,
totally.
You know, and they also wonder about it.
You know, they're walking to the Whole Foods and, you know, you go to that aisle with all the bars and it's like, it's just colors galore, beautiful packaging, all these claims on every box. Each one has a different thing. It's like, oh, this has no sugar alcohols. This has high protein, et cetera, et cetera. This one's organic. How the heck do you know what to choose? Well, in the future, we can look it up like this and figure it out. So for instance, like Clif Bars have a spike around 42 milligrams per deciliter. Wow. That's almost 10 points higher than a Snickers bar. Like, I used to eat those.
I used to live on those things.
Yeah. Right. Go Macro bars have a spike of around 44 milligrams per deciliter. And then you look at some of these others, like Bulletproof bars are like very low, Perfect Keto bars. And so I'm just, you know, this is all just sort of, you're kind of, you know, anecdotal data. This is obviously not controlled trials, but what I get excited about is that person in that aisle who has made the commitment to try to lose weight, to try to be healthier, is not at the mercy of the food marketing, of what the box says. They actually have some agency now in the face of, unfortunately, industries that are, you know, not necessarily aligned with our long-term health. So those are some of the surprising ones that we've seen.
What I've developed are these 10 principles, these food principles
that
allow you to keep your glucose levels steady without giving up all the foods you love. Because personally, Mark, I need a chocolate cake for my birthday. I'm not going to have a Brussels sprout, low carb, no sugar cake. Like, I need chocolate cake. This is a non-negotiable part. You're a bit better human than I am, but like, I love sugar. And so when I first discovered the world of glucose, my fasting glucose levels was 95. I was 23 years old and that was high. And through my hacks, I've lowered it to 79 without giving up all the stuff I love.
And that's two hacks. So we've got the timing of when you eat, what you eat when, right? Vegetables, protein, and starch.
Yes.
And then the vinegar before you eat. What else?
So if anybody is still having a sweet breakfast, this is a very important hack.
Nobody listening to this podcast ever eats a sweet breakfast because they've been listening to this podcast and they know that we should not have dessert for breakfast. But just in case you haven't heard many of the podcasts,
just in case this is the first podcast you listen to. Have a savory breakfast. So in the studies, what they've done is they've taken two groups of people and they've given them two breakfasts, one of two breakfasts, same number of calories. We know calories don't count, but still it's important to mention this. One group had a breakfast that spiked their glucose levels. The other group had a breakfast that kept their glucose levels steady. What happened was, in the group that had the spiky breakfast, they got hungry again after 2 hours. Whereas the group that had the steady glucose breakfast didn't get hungry for 5 hours. So the curve of your breakfast really determines how you're going to feel for the rest of the day and whether you're going to feel in control and connected to your body, or whether walking by that bakery is going to give you an irresistible urge to buy all the cookies like it used to be for me. I used to have a Nutella crepe for breakfast every morning growing up, Mark. And by 10:30, I was starving. I mean,
Nutella
it was bad.
Crepe. Yeah, that'll do it.
But I'm recovered now. I'm recovered. And if I really want a Nutella crepe, what I do is I have it after lunch or dinner as a dessert, and I have some vinegar before. So that's another hack. You know, if you want something
put vinegar on your cookies, is that the thing?
Yeah, just pour vinegar all over my cookies. My friends love me when I come to parties. No, it's having the vinegar in the water before you eat the sweet thing, having the sweet thing after a meal, and also then using your muscles for 10 minutes. So your muscles are really your biggest ally in reducing your glucose spikes. And so what I recommend, it's another hack. After your meals, use your muscles for 10 minutes. Top favorites include dancing to your three favorite songs really loud in your living room, going for a walk with your dog, doing the dishes, the laundry, whatever. Use your muscles. That way you'll curb the spike and you'll feel better.
That's a really important point. I think people don't realize this, but the data is so compelling on what you're saying, which is if you just take a walk after dinner for 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, you will see a dramatic change in your metabolism and your blood sugar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really incredible. And this works particularly well to combat the post-meal sleepiness that a lot of us feel. If you just use your muscles afterwards, you have all this energy again because you're not experiencing such a big crash. And if you can't go outside and you're just home and you're watching, for example, a TV show after dinner or a movie, people can get really creative. So you could do you could hold a plank in front of your couch while you're watching the movie. You could get some kettlebells and do some bicep curls, whatever works, whatever floats your boat. But that'll really help your body deal with the glucose coming through.
Amazing. What else? You've said 10 things. There's a lot more.
I know. I'll give you one more, but then the rest are in my book, Glucose Revolution. One more is putting clothes on your carbs. So what do I mean? Do not let your
clothes
carbs.
Clothes on your carbs.
Uh-huh. Don't let
no
your
naked carbs.
Carbs?
Wash...
No naked carbs. No naked carbs. So anytime
what's a
you're
naked
eating...
carb?
Aha. Uh-huh. So a naked carb is sugar or starch that you're eating on its own. Naked. You just eat it naked and it lands naked and it creates a big glucose spike. So to put clothes on your carbs, what you do is anytime you eat something sweet or something starchy, you make sure to put some protein, fat, or fiber on it. You put some clothes on that. So example, I'm going to take the chocolate cake example. I put Greek yogurt on it if I ever want it in the middle of the day. If you want a piece of sourdough bread, put some avocado on it. Yeah. Put some butter on it. If you ever want to eat some rice, have some eggs with it, some smoked salmon, some greens that you saute.
That's brilliant. I think the idea that we need to not be eating any of this stuff in a way that spikes our blood sugar is key. And what we're learning and what you learned through measuring your blood sugar for years and tracking everything is how different foods affect you. But you know, the interesting thing is that what might affect you might not affect somebody else, and what affects somebody else might not affect you. So can you talk about the differences in glucose metabolism from person to person, depending on their genetics and even their microbiome?
Absolutely. So when I started discovering the world of glucose monitoring, I set a few of my friends up with one as well, and we tested the same foods. So for example, you know, we would eat the same cookie and then compare our glucose spikes. Wow. Turns out mine were always bigger than other people's. And I was like, darn it, I really love cookies. And so I started thinking, you know, what does this mean? Why is my spike so much bigger than my friend Luna's spike? What's going on here? Well, many things could be going on. So as you mentioned, microbiome could be a factor, hydration level, tiredness, how well we had slept the night before, muscle mass, obviously, because your muscles soak up glucose, insulin sensitivity. So, you know, how metabolically healthy we are. And just many more things, the phase of your menstrual cycle, your stress levels, there's a lot of stuff going on there. So it was really interesting to notice what choices might be better for my glucose levels compared to other people. But I kept coming back to the fact that the science shows that the hacks work in all of us. So if me and my friend who both ate the cookie had both put some clothes on the cookie, let's say, you know, 10 almonds, both of our spikes would have been proportionately smaller than the naked cookie spike. So you have to keep that in mind. These principles work for all of us, but then if you have the opportunity to use a glucose monitor, you might discover much more personalized and in-depth, you know, preferences that your body has.
Yeah, you know, Jesse, I remember reading that Israeli study where they looked at the microbiome and how that uniqueness of each of our ecological community that we live in, which is our gut.
That lives in us,
how that actually is so determinant of what happens with our metabolism. And we know from animal studies that if you take the poop out of a skinny mouse and you put it in a fat mouse, the fat mouse will get skinny.
Or in a diabetic to not diabetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you take a healthy, metabolically healthy person, which there's not that many of us around anymore. There's about only 12% of us in America that are metabolically healthy. But if you find a person, good luck, and you transplant their poop into a diabetic, their blood sugar gets better. Yeah. And I remember a case, which I had years ago, I think I might have mentioned on the podcast once, of a gentleman who had type 2 diabetes. We really poorly controlled. His sugars were well over 200 all the time. And we got him down to like 150, but we couldn't just get him all the way normal, even on a ketogenic diet. And one day he called me up and he said, "Dr. Hyman, I'm having a lot of digestive symptoms. I'm bloated, I'm distended, I have all these issues." And I said, "Okay, well, let's do some diagnostic workup, a stool test or anything. But in the meantime, you know, while you're suffering, just try some charcoal to see if that can absorb some of these sort of bloating and the gas and the toxins, which can cause these symptoms." And he did. And then he called me back and says, "Dr. Hyman, I don't know what happened, but my blood sugar went to normal." Don't even understand. And I did understand, because the microbiome plays a huge role in our metabolic health and something called metabolic endotoxemia, which means that the toxins produced by bad bugs in the gut when we eat the wrong things get absorbed and they cause inflammation. The inflammation causes us to be insulin resistant, and that makes us more diabetic. I mean, it's just a whole cascade, a vicious cycle. And so simply by absorbing the metabolic toxins in his gut from bad bugs, we were able to actually correct his blood sugar. So it's quite fascinating. It's not as simple as we think. It's just, oh, just eat this or don't eat that, or exercise or don't exercise. It's kind of a personalized story. And I think there are universal principles, like you mentioned. I think I just want to loop back on something you said before as well, because you talked about these sort of toast that happens when proteins and sugars in your blood and you become toast, and you're literally toast. I mean, it's actually true. You're toasting your system. And there's a phenomenon, it's called advanced glycation end products. And we measure this when we measure our average blood sugar through hemoglobin A1C, which is just measuring the proteins in hemoglobin getting glommed onto by sugar and forming this like crusty creme brulee, like chicken skin, that phenomena, it's called the Maillard reaction, happens inside your body, not just when you're cooking. And that is one of the hallmarks of aging, is the abnormal proteins that form in the body that gum everything up. And this happens in your brain. It's called type 3 diabetes. It happens in your heart, your organs. It really is the phenomena that leads to rapid aging and death. And then what's even funnier is that these things are called AGEs, advanced glycation end products, and they bind to receptors on your cell called RAGEs. So the AGEs make you rage, literally, and turn on all the inflammatory downstream phenomena that we see as inflammation. So it's such an important thing to understand. And regulating your blood sugar is probably the single most important thing you can do. I remember being at Canyon Ranch years ago, and there was a cardiologist that came from Harvard, and he gave a lecture, and he said, you know, if you could take a group of 100-year-old people and you could find a group with clean arteries, they'd have one thing in common. What would that be? They're insulin sensitive, meaning they're very good at keeping their blood sugar even without a lot of insulin. That's the key to longevity and healthy aging. And not just that, but all these other conditions that you mentioned, from acne to infertility to depression to panic attacks to fatigue, energy, insomnia. I mean, night sweats are even a common symptom. You know, men get night sweats too. And often it's because they have these hypoglycemic spikes and they can wake up with soaked sheets. So really important to get your sugar dialed in.
So that's one of the things that happens when we have a glucose spike. It's the toasting. And maybe I can mention something else that happens when our glucose levels spike. So every cell in your body needs energy to function. You know, your brain cells need energy to think, your eye cells to see, your toe cells to dance all night long. Like every cell in your body is really hungry for energy. And the most easy place they get this energy is through glucose that we eat. And so as you digest a meal and glucose goes into your bloodstream, it heads to your cells to be converted to energy. And the little organelles that do this work are mitochondria. They take glucose, turn it into ATP, which is energy. And so you might think, okay, well, if I need energy, then the more glucose I eat, the more energy I have, right? There must be a correlation just like that.
Yeah.
It turns out that's not the case. If you overwhelm your mitochondria with too much glucose, which is the case when a glucose spike happens, your mitochondria don't get excited. They actually shut down. They're like, whoa, whoa, can't deal with all this stuff. Don't know what to do. I'm stressing out. I can't work anymore. Your mitochondria shut down and they get stressed and they release these things called free radicals into your cells. And free radicals, they harm everything that they touch. So if they touch your DNA, they might harm it and create a mutation that could lead to cancer later on. If they touch a cell membrane, they can break the cell membrane and damage the integrity of the cell. So your body's response to these free radicals is inflammation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways that glucose spikes increase inflammation. The problem is, in this case, if it becomes chronic inflammation, it's not good. And that is another thing that creates a terrain for chronic diseases. I mean, 3 out of 5 people are going to die of an inflammation-based disease.
I mean, I don't know if it's 3, it's probably 100%.
I think?
Actually, sure. I mean, unless you get hit by a truck or fall off out of a train or something, I think most of the people die from inflammatory-related conditions. Because all aging itself leads to more inflammation through a whole series of mechanisms, including your blood sugar, including environmental toxins, including your microbiome, including latent infections, including our processed inflammatory diet, including chronic stress. I mean, all the things that we see around us all the time are all driving this inflammatory process. But sugar is sort of the king, queen, and prince of driving inflammation in your body. And so it's such an important thing. It's why I've been talking about this for decades, because, you know, as a doctor seeing patients and testing this stuff when no one else was looking at it, it was like, wow, people are messed up. Like, I would do glucose tolerance tests, not on diabetics, but on almost everybody who came in as a screening test for their metabolic health, because your blood sugar can be perfectly normal and you can still be a mess, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's an important lesson. We've had Dr. Casey Means talk about this on the podcast, talking about how, you know, there's patients who literally have perfectly normal blood sugars, but their insulins are so high that they're keeping their blood sugar normal. And that causes a whole other cascade of problems.
Yeah, because I think insulin increases for 10 years before fasting glucose levels increase.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, the last thing that happens is your fasting glucose going up, right?
Yeah.
And the second thing that, you know, the second to last thing is your fasting glucose goes up, but then your glucose after you eat goes up. Mm-hmm. But that's, again, a late stage phenomena. Earlier stages are high insulin after 2 hours, then high insulin fasting. And then it's like, so we're getting on the train so late in medicine, we need to think about how to go upstream to get to the cause.
Yeah. And for a long time, we only thought diabetics should worry about this. You know, only if you have diabetes should you then think about managing your glucose levels. And by the way, to manage it, just eat better and exercise more. I mean, come on. We need to give people the hacks, Mark. We need everybody to be using this because it's so easy.
Yeah. So eat better. People have no clue what that means.
No.
The other thing I wanted to sort of jump into was hormones, right? We talked about aging, we talked about heart disease, but, you know, one of the real problems with sugar is screwing up our hormones, both for men and women. And can you take us down how that works and what goes wrong and why it's so common to see such hormonal chaos in this country?
Absolutely. I think one of the conditions that is becoming more and more prevalent, especially in my community, I'm noticing that the numbers are increasing so much, is polycystic ovarian syndrome. And this is a condition where women stop getting their period, their ovaries become burdened with cysts, they start displaying masculine traits like hair on the chin, balding, etc. And this is something that often we're told to just medicate, oh, just take the pill and it'll fix it. It turns out actually that polycystic ovarian syndrome is a disease of too much insulin.
Yeah.
And we know, yeah. And the way it works is fascinating. So when your body has too much insulin in it, it's not as good as it was before at converting male hormones into female hormones. So you end up with people who have uteruses who have this excess of testosterone in their body.
Yeah.
So their female hormones are just not working anymore.
Yeah. And you get, they grow beards.
Yes.
And they get acne.
Don't get your period anymore. Yes.
And they lose the hair on their head. So women get bald. And you ever see this kind of women with a big round middle and their hair is all thin and like looks like they're going bald on top?
So many.
Whiskers going.
It's heartbreaking.
It's really from sugar.
Mark. Yeah, because they don't know that the reason this is happening is because of too much insulin. And the reason there's too much insulin is because their glucose levels are out of whack. And so what's really empowering, I think, is when women start applying the principles, the science-backed stuff that I share, because they're able to get their period back within months. A few women even got pregnant, even though they had been told they were infertile. And this is so empowering because we have power. We have power. It starts in our plate. And this is really a message of hope. So anybody listening, like, this can really benefit you. And I hope you'll find a lot of relief in this information.
Yeah, it's not your DNA. It's your dinner.
I love that.
So here's the deal. In men, the opposite sort of thing happens. So what happens men, right? What happens to men when they eat too much sugar and starch is they actually produce, because they produce way more fat cells, and the fat cells have a compound called aromatase, which converts testosterone into estrogen. And so the men get man boobs, and they get soft skin, and they lose the hair on their bodies, so they become more like women. So basically, men become more like women, women become more like men. It creates this massive chaos in the hormones. And I just want to reinforce what you're saying, because you say glucose. And most people, when they think of glucose, they think of sugar. But you should think of bread or sugar or cornflakes in exactly the same way. In fact, bread is the gold standard for measuring glycemic index. And it's worse than sugar. The score for bread is 100. The score for sugar is 80. So actually, you're better off having the sugar than the bread.
I would disagree, Mark, because in the sugar, there's also fructose. And all the things we talked about, you know, the aging, the inflammation, fructose does it at an even higher rate than glucose alone.
That's true.
I would argue that if you have a choice between something starchy and something sweet, I would go for the starchy thing. But better even, have some vegetables first, then some protein and fat, and then have the starchy thing. And maybe you won't even want to have the sugary thing at the end.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I also say, if you're going to have starch, have starch that's in forms that are coming in a good package. So for example, I have a Japanese purple sweet potato at night.
Yum.
I love that, which is starch, but it's got full of phytochemicals and fiber and vitamins and minerals, and I eat the skin. So it's really actually a very healthy food, and it's quite different than eating white bread, which is also a starch. So starches and starches and starch. It really depends on where it's coming from and how it's metabolized. Even oatmeal versus steel-cut oats, profoundly different.
Absolutely. And this is, so what I've been doing in my work is testing all these things on my own body and using a continuous glucose monitor, showing people the different spikes that happen. So I tested steel-cut oats versus regular oatmeal, and the steel-cut has a smaller spike. And same for bread. So white bread is far worse than something like sourdough, for example, which is worse than something like very dark pumpernickel bread that's all gooey and feels almost like
Germany.
A cake because it's so rich of fiber. Yeah, from Germany. So it's always a spectrum, right? You have to think within a category. There's different types of bread, different types of potatoes, different types of starch, and you can always make a choice that's a bit better. And you can always add some fiber to it and some vinegar and go for a walk after.
So basically, throw some Metamucil and some vinegar on your food and you're good, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Sounds delicious.
So tell us some of the surprising things, Jesse, that you learned about your own body and in researching this, about what you thought was okay to eat but actually wasn't, or what you thought wasn't okay to eat but actually maybe was okay.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, I used to have donuts for breakfast. So I really got a cold shower in terms of nothing sweet first thing in the morning. Because first thing in the morning, when your body is completely fasted, your glucose levels will respond incredibly fast to anything that you ingest. So I realized that if I wanted to eat something sweet, for example, a donut, I should never, ever, ever eat it on an empty stomach. I should always eat it after a meal.
Yeah.
Then in terms of other surprising things, I mean, oatmeal was a big one because they even say oatmeal is for diabetics. I mean, there's all this information that's very confusing. Yeah. Rice cakes. Oh my God.
Oatmeal's not a health food.
No, it's not. Rice cakes. This is crazy.
Brown rice cakes. How could they be bad?
I tested brown rice versus white rice. Literally no difference.
Well, what if you put like nut butter on top?
Then it's perfect. That sounds really gross, but it probably works.
I love it. That's my favorite thing. I get the rice cakes and I put like macadamia butter.
On the rice cake. I thought you meant put the nut butter on actual rice, like warm rice.
No. You get a rice cake and you put on the nut butter and it's kind of good.
Then that works.
Yeah.
I think
all the breakfast things are really in this country so geared toward extremely high levels of starch and sugar. And fruit juice is terrible. Right? And I think people need to realize that the most important thing they need to do when they eat in the morning, eat plenty of protein, fat, and fiber.
Yes.
Because those are the magic tricks to actually keep your blood sugar normal. Protein, fat, and fiber. And you have to learn what foods have protein, fat, and fiber. It's a little bit of an education because, people may not know, but it actually is the key to success. And you're basically saying eat protein, fat, and fiber before you eat any starch or sugar. And that will mitigate all the results.
Give us the big picture overview on blood sugar management. Your first big number one bestseller was all on this topic. And tell us why blood sugar is so connected to what we perceive internally as our energy going up and down throughout the day.
Well, we recently partnered with a company called Levels, which is a fascinating company that measures continuous glucose throughout the day. So you're measuring your glucose all the time. And you can see, depending on what you're eating, it's going up and down. And we recently did a podcast with Casey Means, who founded it. And it was fascinating to see the foods that just jack your sugar up and down. And when your sugar is going up and down, you're on a roller coaster of energy and crash and refuel. And that's where people end up with this tremendous amounts of weight gain and fatigue and buzzes and mood issues and all kinds of other health complications. So sugar is really nasty. And if you understand it's a drug, if you understand it's very powerful, if you understand that if you use it, it has to be used as a drug. Like you wouldn't drink a bottle of tequila at a sitting. You might have one little shot or two in the context of a meal. And I think, you can have sugar. It's not saying I don't ever have sugar, but I think it's when you have it, how you have it, with what you have it, and how much you have. So I think for most people trying to sort of reset their energy levels, cutting out sugar and starch and eating protein and vegetables for a week, doing the 10-day detox diet essentially, is an amazing way to actually recalibrate their metabolism, their brain chemistry, and their energy.
Yeah, and we have a podcast, and you've done one as well. I've done one where we actually talk about like the top 10 most popular foods that will spike your blood sugar and put you on this roller coaster that you have a super high, and then you end up having a crash afterwards. And for a lot of people who go through the standard 3 p.m., 2 p.m., 4 p.m., midday crash, it's often because of what they're eating early in the day. So doing something like Levels could give you insight on what you're eating and how that's throwing your blood sugar off. So we'll link to that inside of the show notes.
We had an interesting conversation about that with Casey, where she said that a Clif bar, which we all think is a healthy snack, had a worse glycemic index load than Snickers. So you don't really always know. You think something's healthy and it's like, could be just jacking up in sugar and down. So I'm very careful about that. Somebody sent me a promotion for a new kind of ice cream, and that's my Achilles heel. I love ice cream. It's supposed to be the best ice cream, but it's still got like, 5 teaspoons of sugar in a serving. So it's like, you got to be careful.
Right. And a lot of this is not, you don't ever have those foods ever. It's about being smart about it, making sure that it's not part of your regular baseline. That's what sets us up for chronic disease. And more importantly, how to eat and exercise and move and sleep in a way that allows you to enjoy certain things. For instance, in your podcast with Casey Mark, I remember you guys talking about how eating a little bit of fat, fiber, and protein, for example, like instead of eating berries on an empty stomach, right? Fruit has so many amazing phytonutrients and other properties and polyphenols inside of it. But if you eat a ton of fruit on an empty stomach, that'll do one thing to your blood sugar versus if you have it at the end of a meal where you had a lot of healthy fat, fiber, and protein. that was there.
Yeah. It's called the glycemic load. It's basically, you know, what the total composition of your meal will do to your blood sugar. So if you add in fat and protein, if you add in fat and protein and fiber, it basically acts like a sponge and slows the absorption of the sugar. So you don't get the spikes, then you don't get the insulin surges, which then means you don't get the blood sugar crashes. And so it all evens out.
So as a functional medicine doctor, you also know that not everything is what we eat and movement and sleep, although that's a huge part of it. There's other aspects, which is, call it like emotional debt, things that we have in our mind, stuff that's unresolved that we're just kind of kicking the can down the road. How have you seen that that can zap people's energy, both in your own life, your personal life, but also conversations with your patients who are struggling with fatigue?
Yeah. I mean, often it's, I remember this one patient, she was early 50s, still living with her mother, who was incredibly critical of her still. And the mother was like in her 80s or something. And she was struggling with her weight and metabolism and her health and energy. And I said, listen, you need a motherectomy. Like, you need to move out. And I think sometimes the stress that people are under just causes huge amounts of changes in their brain chemistry and their metabolism and leads to a lot of fatigue. I mean, depression, one of the key symptoms of depression is fatigue. So I think it's really important for people to look at their lives and go, where are things not right? Where are things out of alignment? Where am I out of integrity with myself, with my family, with my work, with my life dreams and goals, and start to correct those problems and figure out what it is. Because those are big energy zappers.
Is there something that you notice in your body, whether it's shortness of breath or a little pit in your stomach or tightness in your neck? You know, everybody has something that's usually an indication that there's something weighing on me emotionally, even if I'm not fully present to what it is. And I got to do a little bit of an inventory to see, like, man, why do I feel so run down right now?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is a different process. Journaling is a great way every morning for people to journal. I think focusing on things like gratitude is a huge way to sort of reset your framework and your mindset. You know, our beliefs and our attitudes and our perceptions really determine our quality of life. And so if we're kind of in a negative loop, it's really important to figure out how to get out of that. And there's a lot of ways to do that through therapy, through self-practices that people can do, through meditation. But it's really looking to become a master of your mind. Because if you're not a master of your mind's running you, you're not running your life. And I think, Drew, you really are very good at this. You're one of the people I know who's best at this, at really looking at how do you have integrity in your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions. Because that's how life works. You get a thought, it creates a feeling, it's an action. And if you don't straighten out your thoughts, your feelings and actions are going to be messy, and they're going to lead to all kinds of problems, including disease and fatigue and many other issues.
Okay. So what does Mark Hyman do? What does Dr. Mark Hyman do when he feels a little stuck, a little bit in the rut? And it could be emotional, it could be physical, it could be a blend of the two, but what's your go-to, like actual go-to? You feel a little fatigued, you feel a little bit in the rut, you know, it's not your baseline, but you feel off. Could have been after a bunch of travel, could have been you spread yourself too thin. What do you actually do in your life to bring back that energy?
Well, I know there's a list of things that give me energy, and there's the things that deplete my energy. So I get rid of the things that deplete my energy and add in all the things that give me energy. So things that deplete my energy: not sleeping enough, running around too much, not eating well, not exercising, all that stuff, not meditating. I just lean back on the things that I know work. So meditation is a huge thing for me for energy. It gives me so much energy. Getting enough sleep, hot and cold therapy, huge for me. Like if I do a sauna or steam and an ice bath, it's amazing. I get my energy back. Exercise, whether it's working out with weights or going for a bike ride or doing yoga, always gives me energy. I can go into an energy. I remember when I had chronic fatigue, actually, it was really quite interesting. I was so exhausted and always had pain and fatigue and brain fog and just not able to do life very well at all. And the only time I would feel really good, or the only two times I could really reset myself, were hot and cold. That would give me like an hour of feeling a little more energy and clarity. And also like a yoga class. I would do a very intense yoga class. It wasn't even a hot yoga, but if I do hot yoga, which is hard to do now because of COVID, but it's such a powerful reset. So I could walk in there dragging, feeling tired, wanting to take a nap. I come out of the yoga after an hour and I just feel rejuvenated and alive and clear and energetic. And I was sort of shocked when I had chronic fatigue that that was one of the few things that actually would reset my nervous system.
So Mark, let's give a case study. And I can't think of a better one than your own case study. You've written a lot about it. You've talked a lot about it, but we're going to go in more detail in today's podcast. So as you mentioned, you had chronic fatigue. Walk us through what you actually did and maybe even who helped you down the process of getting to the root of what your particular contributions were that were ending in this result of chronic fatigue.
Well, you know, it was ultimately a blessing and a curse, right? It felt like a curse at the time because I could barely function. I couldn't get out of bed. I was unable to have any really clear thinking. I was barely able to work. I had a job, thank God, where I could work from 9 to 4, 3 days a week. And at lunch, I could go get a massage or do a steam or a sauna and an ice dip so I could literally function in the afternoon. And it was one of the most difficult periods of my life. And I didn't know what to do.
And just to interject on your story, right? Just because I think this is really just, I'm curious for myself. You were also a single parent at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Going through divorce, a single father, alcoholic ex-wife, was kind of a messy time as well. So there was this psychological stress as well. Huge. And that underscored it all. But what really my own illness did was teach me functional medicine from the inside out and how to unpack what's wrong with somebody and how many layers there can be to actually getting better. So I didn't know what was wrong, just felt like crap. My immune system wasn't working. I was exhausted. And this is not just like, oh, I'm tired. Let me take a sleep and I'll get better. You never feel better. So you can sleep 10 hours. You wake up feeling like you haven't slept at all. It's one of the worst things you can imagine suffering from. And I feel so much compassion for those who do because it's real and most doctors have no clue how to deal with it. And now, thank God, you know, when I had it, it was like, oh, you know, take Prozac. You know, now there's a lot of literature and science about the biology and the inflammatory cytokines and all the things that we actually can measure in people who are chronically fatigued. So for me, I didn't know what it was. And my gut was a mess. Everything was a mess. So I started just sort of learning about functional medicine and I discovered that I had mercury poisoning. That was the first thing. And that was huge for me to get rid of the mercury. And it took me a long time. It took me probably 5 years or more to get rid of the mercury through chelation and IV therapy and avoiding fish and doing all the foods that upregulated my detox pathways. And I really learned about the science of detoxification, of heavy metal treatment. And that was big, but it didn't get me all the way better.
And can I ask one quick question about mercury, Mark?
Yeah.
How is it? Connect the dots. How is it that something like having excess mercury in your body could invoke something like chronic fatigue or make it worse? What is actually happening?
Well, so fatigue is coming from mitochondria damage. So mitochondria are your energy factories, and they produce energy that runs everything in your body. That's your energy. It's called ATP or adenosine triphosphate. And it's made by you breathe oxygen and you eat food, and that gets metabolized in your little mitochondria, which are little engines inside your cell. They are critical for everything in your body to function and for aging and longevity and everything else. And I ended up having really bad functioning mitochondria based on my testing. I had elevated muscle enzymes, meaning my muscle cells and my cells were just being damaged because of something, and I didn't know what. And it was really painful and really, really difficult. And the chelation test showed me I had a super high level of mercury that was damaging my mitochondria. And mercury and any toxin damage mitochondria. They're very sensitive, but they also damage your metabolism. They damage your immune system. They damage your brain. They damage your hormones. They have wide-reaching effects across the body that screw everything up. The main symptoms are fatigue, cognitive impairment, autoimmune disease, gut issues, insomnia, anxiety, depression. I mean, these are the symptoms of heavy metal poisoning. And again, it's missed most of the time because most traditional doctors have no clue on how to diagnose it and certainly not how to treat it. I mean, I literally got an email from a patient the other week. I know it wasn't a patient. I think some guy randomly found me online, whatever. And he's like, Dr. Hyman, I know you've had mercury issues. I went to my doctor. I heard your stuff. And I've been eating sushi like 3 times a week for like a bazillion years. And I know it's probably affecting me and I have all these symptoms. I went to my doctor and they're like, oh, not worth testing. Nothing you're going to do about it. Just stop eating fish. And that was the end of the story. And I'm like, oh my goodness, that is just such a sad thing because he has all this mercury stored in his body. You need to get it out. So that's really important. And functional medicine is really good at helping design a safe way to remove heavy metals and other toxins from your system. So toxins is number one. But then I wasn't all the way better. And then I realized, it is just kind of stupid and kind of shows how doctors are the worst patients. But I was like, I'm feeling a little tired. Let me check my Lyme test. And I live up in the woods in the Northeast and there's a lot of Lyme. And I checked Lyme and all these co-infections and ticks. And then I know, so busy working and running around saving the world and being Dr. Hyman, I forgot to look at my result because I did my own test. And I opened it up and one day I was like, what happened to that test? And like, I was like, oh no, because I had a PCR positive Lyme, which means not like, oh, I might have Lyme or it's maybe Lyme. It's like actively replicating in my blood, which is not good. And I also had Babesia. And so then I went down that whole rabbit hole of treating my own tick infections, which was very challenging. And, you know, you have to use antibiotics and herbs and this and that. And it was still really hard. And then I found out a number of years later that I lived in a moldy house. I lived in a 1825 post office that was converted to a house in a small New England town. And the basement was just full of mold. And I knew it, but at the time, I didn't really know that much about mold and didn't connect the dots. And that was also contributing. And so I literally have had to deal with all these things. You know, normally it's like, oh yeah, you eat bad and you don't exercise and you're stressful. I had all that down. It was all the stuff that, you know, happened in my environment, like toxins and mold and ticks and infections. And so for me, it's been a multi-decade long process of unraveling the root causes of my own dysfunction.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. One of the best ways you can support this podcast is by leaving us a rating and review below. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy. Make sure to check out Gut Food and learn more at gutfood.com.
And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter. And in it, I share my favorite stuff, from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger longer.
Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.